Hello, this is Harry Pearson, and welcome to ArtCast. ArtCast is a panel-style discussion podcast featuring panel members from inside and outside Microsoft as they discuss and debate architectural topics. Each month, we'll feature a new topic and new panelists, and we will post their ongoing discussions weekly. For more information, please visit the Architecture Resource Center at microsoft.com/architecture. This week, we continue the discussion of model-driven development. The discussion ranges from considering organizational and individual role changes to the importance of expertise in the development of modeling languages.
Hi, this is Martin Danner with Arrowrock Corporation in Boise, Idaho. I'm impressed with the comments of each panelist in last week's ArtCast. They all had interesting observations on the past, present, and future of model-driven development. I really like Jack Greenfield's pragmatic approach to modeling. In particular, I like the way that software factories combine modeling with guidance in the form of patterns, code samples, templates, and wizards. This blended approach seems essential to the success of software factories. As Jack pointed out, we don't always know enough about a domain to model it effectively. However, we do have bits and pieces of knowledge that we can reuse and rearrange into new designs and implementations. I like to think of these bits and pieces of knowledge, these guidance components, as building blocks. Just like Legos, you can assemble these blocks in different ways to come up with new and unique structures. Another feature of software factories that I like is the fact that it embraces multiple viewpoints. Clearly, software for a mobile phone is completely different from, say, accounting software. Each embodies concepts that are different from one another. Although they both consist of ones and zeros at the executable level, at the conceptual level they are very different domains. It's exciting to think that the tools have matured to the point where we can now model each domain using a custom toolbox full of elements tailored to best express the concepts involved. Because, after all, as application developers, most of the creative work that we do is at the conceptual level. Steve Kelly pointed out that both the modeling tool and the code generators that transform the models into code need to be domain-specific. He offered an interesting definition of a domain, which I found useful. He described a domain as a narrow range of applicability, such as a single range of products from a single company. Certainly, the people creating solutions for such a domain have developed the terminology for describing the concepts within that domain. Why not use that terminology as the basis for a modeling language for the domain? Now they can build their own specialized modeling tools that allow them to create solutions much faster using familiar concepts, and then convert those models into code that looks and feels like the code that they themselves would have written. Now that sounds like progress to me. I agree with Mauro Reggio's comments that models should be XML-based. XML allows you to perform various operations on the model, such as validation and transformation, using the rich set of tools already available to manipulate XML. What's more, it opens up the possibility of automatically generating models from other sources. This poses some intriguing possibilities in the areas of reverse engineering, converting and merging models, and ground-tripping between models and the artifacts that they generate. Mauro also pointed out that the modeling tool must be extensible so that it can be adapted as domain knowledge increases, or as the domain itself evolves and changes. This sort of flexibility is unprecedented, and the lack of this flexibility may have been a major reason why case tools failed to meet expectations. I do take exception with one of Mauro's comments, though. He said that faster, better, cheaper is not the point. Sure, that might be a catchy bit of marketing speak, but I think the underlying premise is spot on. In my opinion, the whole motivation for model-driven development is to simultaneously increase developer productivity, improve the quality of the software produced, and drive down the enormous cost of software development. And I'd like to add one other reason for model-driven development, coping with ever-increasing complexity. As Brand Selleck pointed out, software is one of the most complicated things we've ever attempted to do, in some cases rivaling biological systems in complexity. And it's getting more complex all the time. How are we as mere mortals going to cope with this ever-increasing complexity? How are we going to fit bigger and bigger ideas into our brains? I think Brand has exactly the right idea when he says that abstraction and automation are essential to dealing with the complexity. Model-driven development embraces abstraction by allowing us to ignore implementation details and focus on the concepts. Model-driven development also embraces automation by allowing us to automatically transform conceptual models into executable implementations. And the new crop of modeling tools gives us an unprecedented degree of control over both the modeling environment and the transformation to implementation. So, the question still remains, how will existing IT organizations adopt this new approach to software development? To me, it implies a new kind of organization. Domain-specific models and guidance automation are new tools that architects and developers can add to their existing bag of tricks. For them, these represent an evolutionary improvement in the tools they're already used to working with. As such, I think that adoption will be primarily a training issue, as is true with the introduction of any new technology. The more profound and fundamental change imposed by model-driven development is the need for organizations to create their own domain-specific languages, patterns, templates, and other forms of guidance. This implies a whole new job category, perhaps best described as factory builder. These factory builders, the people who produce the domain-specific modeling tools, patterns, templates, and so forth, will require a special skill set, a new skill set. I don't think that the skill set exists in today's IT organizations. It will require highly experienced developers working in a completely new way to produce new kinds of deliverables. This amounts to a significant change in both the structure and culture of the IT organization. As Brand pointed out, this culture change could well be the biggest impediment to the success of model-driven development. So what is it going to take to produce this paradigm shift? Perhaps that's not a fair question to pose to the panel, as our expertise is primarily technical. However, I think it's a question that must be answered if model-driven development is to enjoy mainstream adoption and be considered ready for prime time.
Hi, this is Jack Greenfield with Week 2. I'd like to respond to Stephen Kelly's observation in Week 1 that case tools failed to fulfill their promises because they forced three things on their users: a way of working, a way of modeling, and a way of coding. Let's look at each of these in turn. Most methodologies currently on the market have the same problem that Case did. Namely, they prescribe a one-size-fits-all approach regardless of the type of problem being solved. So you'd get the same advice regardless of, say, whether you're building eBay or software for an anti-lock braking system running on an embedded controller in an automobile. Of course, these are two very different domains. For eBay, we have large numbers of concurrent users to manage, and we have to expose financial transactions to the threats of the Internet. Whereas with the anti-lock braking system, we have limited resources, we have to work in near real time, and we have safety critical issues to deal with. Software factories, by contrast, don't prescribe a specific methodology. Instead, you could think of software factories as a meta-methodology. The authors of a software factory define the process, architecture, guidelines, and tools followed by the users. These components can be tuned and tailored for the specific problem domain. Also, with Case, since models were the dominant artifact and code took a back seat, existing tools such as CM systems, debuggers, defect tracking systems were therefore much less useful than they once had been. With software factories, by contrast, we manage models as ordinary source artifacts. Therefore, most of the existing tools can be used with models and the metadata they carry just as easily as they can be used with code. Now, it's true that we can enhance these tools using the metadata captured by models as described in our book, and we've already started doing that with Visual Studio Team System, for example. As time goes on, we'll see more and more use of metadata. However, in the meantime, we can use the tools as they're currently defined. This is a key property of software factories. Now let's talk about modeling. As you know, with software factories, you can define your own domain-specific languages instead of accepting a set of languages prescribed by a committee that presumes to know exactly what your problems are and how you're going to solve them using models. More importantly, software factories let you identify the domains of interest for your problem domain, your architecture, and your process. In other words, defining domain-specific languages for a particular family of systems in a software factory is not just about bubbles versus squares. It's about choosing what parts of a system to model, at what level of abstraction, and what aspects of each part need to be captured, and how they should be captured. Now, at this point, some people might ask whether or not it's a good idea to allow software factory developers to define their own modeling language. After all, the UML was designed by experts, and it still has a lot of issues, as we know, issues for which it's been roundly criticized. However, it's interesting to note that the UML was also designed by a committee. And of course, you know the parable about the elephant, giraffe, and rhinoceros, which were all horses designed by committee. Rather than have a committee design a general-purpose modeling language to solve all possible problems, we think it makes sense to have software factory developers define individual, focused languages to solve very specific problems. Unlike the committee that can't possibly know in advance what the problems are that need to be solved, these software factory authors can be experts in their problem domains, in the architectures used to support the software that will address those problems, and they can therefore define languages that are precisely tuned for the tasks at hand. Finally, let's talk about a way of coding. Martin asked in week one whether or not models will be first-class artifacts throughout the software lifecycle. I think they can be and should be, especially if we don't round-trip. And there are many effective ways of separating generated and handwritten code, as described in the article that we published on MSDN. For me, the bigger issue, at least for the time being, is whether or not code will remain a first-class artifact throughout the software lifecycle. Or will the model-driven development technologies that we bring to market now make the same mistake as Case, trying to replace the code entirely by models? While that may be possible at some distant day in the future, today it's just not practical. For this reason, we want to treat code as a first-class citizen. Models are first-class citizens, but not dominant. All of the types of artifacts required to build software in the real world today are peers in a software factory. When the day finally does come that we can generate all of the code for a system from models, as we currently do from programming languages with compilers, we'll see that no one tool or language will be able to meet the needs of all systems. Instead, we'll find that multiple modeling languages and multiple tools will be required. Why is that? Well, because unlike with a programming language where we're abstracting a single physical or virtual machine, with models we're abstracting a variety of different forms of platform abstractions, including servers and operating system components and middleware elements, and we're mapping those abstractions onto a wide variety of problem domain concepts. This concludes my comments for week two. Talk to you next week.
Hi, this is Stephen Kelly from Metacase. Jack Greenfield is right in drawing a distinction between NDA and domain-specific modeling. Industrial experiences of DSM consistently show it to be much faster than current practices, including current UML-based implementations of NDA. As DSM has been happening for well over a decade, there are a number of well-documented, objectively analyzed real-world cases. I guess Mara Reggio wasn't aware of these, and if you want to see some, then take a look at www.dsmforum.org. The industrial cases there consistently show productivity increasing by a factor of 5 to 10, so 500 to 1,000%. In contrast, even the flagship MDA study, sponsored by an MDA tool company in a laboratory scenario, only showed an increase of 35%. Even MDA hardliners like Grady Booch, along with Bran Selick and the other IBM luminaries, recognize this, as they say in their article in the MDA Journal last year. The full value of MDA is only achieved when the modeling concepts map directly to domain concepts rather than computer technology concepts. In other words, when the modeling language used is domain-specific rather than being UML. They're absolutely correct in that, and they're also correct in agreeing that such a vision is a long way off still from current MDA tools. Where I would disagree with Jack is when he says the model-driven development world can be categorized into MDA and software factories, and that these are the two leading approaches. He's right that the clearest division is between MDA and the rest, but I don't think many people in the rest would accept being labeled under software factories. For one thing, it's not necessarily the most appropriate or even flattering of names, being all too easily misunderstood as a false analogy between programmers and factory assembly line workers, and also, disconcertingly, having the same abbreviation as science fiction. Humor aside, the software factories approach is intriguing in that it tries to include pretty much everything that people in this decade know to be good practice in code-based software development. So patterns, components, frameworks, aspects, services. Now, these are all great things, and we should be using them, but they're not really the key issues for model-driven development. For model-driven development to work, I think everyone agrees that we need domain-specific modeling languages and domain-specific code generators. These two are included in Microsoft's vision, and indeed from my point of view, they form the key differentiating factor between how decent developers are already programming and the new visions in the Software Factories book. For my money, the best term for the new way of software development would be something like domain-specific modeling with full code generation. But as that's a bit of a mouthful, DSM will do. DSM also shares its abbreviation with a rather more appropriate partner, DSM Cars, which are, according to the DSM Tuners website, relatively easy to modify for big performance with basic bolt-on parts. Now certainly, if you have good tools, then getting big performance out of DSM should be relatively easy. and I personally side with those who think that the tools to create modeling languages should be as easy to use as bolting things together. Creating a modeling language is hard, as Martin Danner said, and something that currently few people are expert at. Having a toolset that makes the process easy is a key success factor, allowing you to concentrate on what you want in the modeling language, rather than how to code a modeling tool for that language. The increase in productivity with a DSM language correlates strongly with how well that modeling language has been built to fit its domain. Perhaps even more importantly, allowing the modeling language designer to work on a high-level view of the modeling language, with the tool doing any necessary hard work, allows the modeling language to evolve freely later. Nobody gets a modeling language right first time, and nobody works in a domain that is completely static. If getting modeling tool support for your new modeling language requires significant amount of coding, there'll soon come a point when the amount of tool code changes a new modeling language feature would require make that change impractical. That's the point at which your modeling language begins to go the way of the dinosaurs. For DSM to be successful, then, it must be carried out with tools that support modeling language evolution. To date, I've seen over 20 tools for building DSM support, and not a single one has enabled evolution in its first generation. It seems that only once a vendor's first generation tool has been through a few versions, and then been thrown away, has the vendor been able to build their second generation tool from scratch to enable modeling language evolution. That's been our experience too with MetEdit Plus, whose predecessor was built and scrapped after three versions in the late 80s and early 90s. It's rather like the problem of getting Microsoft Word to allow evolution of its document standard. Only with Word 97, the fourth version, did Microsoft manage to make a tool whose document format allowed you to just keep on updating without having to do some kind of manual conversions or special file converters. So then, if, as Bram Selleck rightly said, the key success factors when using a DSM language are the level of abstraction and automation, and these are also the key factors when building a DSM language and its tool support. So if you like the idea of DSM, whether you're a modeler, a modeling language designer, or a vendor, you better start eating the dog food.
Hi, this is Brian Selleck of IBM. I enjoyed listening to the opening statements of my co-panelists, and I'm really glad to hear that we all share an optimism about model-driven development and its potential. One thing that Jack Greenfield mentioned that particularly struck me is the need to approach this problem from a pragmatic angle. And what I'd like to say next is focused on the pragmatics of model-driven development. I think it's useful to define model-driven development as a mode of development in which the model becomes the dominant artifact in the whole development process. In somewhat disagreement with Jack, though, I think there's more than just two different forms and degrees of model-driven development. It varies. There's many different ways of doing it, many different forms, from simple round-trip engineering to fully-fledged use of modeling languages as programming languages. The key thing, of course, is that as we increase the levels of abstraction automation, we are getting higher and higher benefits in terms of productivity and quality. However, there are certain pragmatic issues that get in the way of just leaping from, say, traditional program-based development towards model-driven development in its fullest forms. For example, the tools are not as mature as we might want them to be, not just the tools, but also modeling languages. For example, languages such as UML have been exposed to a great deal of criticism, even though they were designed by experts and various software gurus. So it's not an easy thing to design a domain-specific language, and yet we have to be quite careful when we start off with something that enables people to design their own languages easily, to not give them too much rope, as the saying goes. For example, if we look at what happened with programming languages, there is not a profusion of domain-specific programming languages, and that's quite interesting to understand why. And again, the pragmatics come into it. Languages need tools that are beyond just editors and code generators. They need make utilities, intelligent repositories, version management tools, debugging tools, analysis tools, testing tools, documentation tools, etc. And it took us a long time to develop these tools to a sufficient quality for programming languages, and it's going to be even harder to develop tools like that for modeling languages. So we have to be careful here not to repeat the case tool mistake of creating expectations that we cannot meet because the technology is immature. We must not ignore the pragmatics.
Thanks for listening. I'm the host of ArtCast, Harry Pearson. Don't forget the conversation continues next week, so tune in.